Sibone Hang.
Hello, Nat Bibby. How are you? It's so weird seeing this Nathaniel here. I'm so used to just seeing Nat everywhere. So,
for those of you that haven't come across Sibone Hang, she has been somebody I've been following for a year, and I'm going to give you my like off the cuff version introduction because it's very rare. Like I, you know, when I follow somebody for a year, it's very rare that I can say somebody, you know, adds value with 100% of the things they put up online. Sibone never fails to. When I check in with what she's doing, every post adds value. Every time she's involved in anything, it adds value. We started in, well, I would call it entertainment, but broadcasting in the media business, CNBC and the likes. I've seen you on the red carpet with a few celebs as well. And is now, you know, a professional speaker. And is also a speaking coach. But, you know, with speaking coaches, like I've worked with a few now, there's not many that are actually practicing what they preach at the same time. And Sibone definitely is. So, Sibone, would you be able to give us your version of your background?
Oh, my gosh. That was such a lovely, like, sincere and authentic introduction, firstly. Thank you. So I'm from Perth as well, from where Nat is from, born in Singapore but raised in Perth. And sadly, our paths never crossed. But I left early and started my career in Asia, first in radio and also on TV for cable network that you might know, HBO in Asia, and then got poached to go to Dubai, where I was for 5 years working for Virgin Radio in Dubai, Richard Branson, and did CNN while I was there. And then came back to Singapore for 4 years and was working for like the national broadcaster here. And really at that time started to see that old media, for many reasons, I should say traditional media, for many reasons, wasn't really floating my boat anymore. I think I came to the point where I was like, I'm not adding value. I'm not even really that entertaining because of the restrictions that I had working for the national like mouthpiece, basically. And I started to kind of die a little bit inside, which I think anyone here, particularly our LinkedIn users who are professionals, we've all maybe had those moments at our job where we've gone, hey, how am I serving people? How is what I'm doing impacting the world at all? And realized that pretty quickly I had to make a contingency plan. And I always wanted to be a speaker. But when you're in your 20s, you like your message is just gestating, right? You're percolating what you're going to talk about. You really don't have it yet. And so everything happened really at the right intersection of time. I had a mentor at the time who recommended that I do the topic of human connection. At the same time as that, I was seeing, you know, a lot of things in my personal life with my mum who has dementia, not being able to connect with me. And then also disconnection within a super toxic workplace. Everywhere I looked, connection was like hitting me in the face. And so that became my topic. I went to set up my business in July of 2019 and then got booked immediately because of LinkedIn on global stages and was speaking, and then boom, the pandemic hit. And then I was just really lucky because of my broadcasting background that I could use video really well, so I could do virtual speeches immediately. And that allowed me to serve people. I mean, if you can give people what they need in a time of crisis, I think that that's the greatest gift. It was the opposite of the lack of impact I'd felt over the 4 years. It was the opposite. It was like every day I would open my social media to someone asking me in Africa to speak about human connection for free, you know, on IG Live or whatever. And it was a really frenetic time, I'm sure, as it is for everybody watching this, but it was great to be able to serve people during that time, which is a year ago now, imagine.
Yeah. So I've read your bio on your website and so on, and this is your mission. Like you're on a mission to make the world more connected, and this pandemic's hit, and we're already like becoming more disconnected. The world was heading in that direction in any event, and then all of a sudden we're all in lockdown, and you must have felt like a real sense of calling, like, you know, that your purpose was needed more than ever during that time.
Well, I wasn't sleeping now. I was like the urgency with which I, because I had been speaking on stages, so I had a keynote, but you know, beyond a keynote speech, which you can speak to people in an organization, what about online content? What about articles? What about your social media platforms? All of these things, which I had been propagating, but kind of been doing it at my own pace. And then there was this sense of urgency, and it was such a blessing for me because I really got to define my perspective on the topic. And there are other people who speak on the topic of human connection, but it's what your perspective is on it that makes you as a specialist, you know, unique. And I think during the pandemic, obviously Black Lives Matter happened. And what was interesting to me was, if we look at all the people who speak on human connection in the world, I'm the only female of color. And so I can't help but think the volume of work that I get also is to do with the multinational corporations having a mandate that they want women of color on their panels, in their conferences. And I don't say this with like any sort of, I don't think I'm good enough to be chosen without it. But I've waited many, many years for that to happen, always being sidelined kind of in my broadcasting career because of my ethnicity. And then so to see this change, it just felt like everything aligned.
That's very interesting. You're amazing what you do, Simone. I think, you know, I haven't heard any other human connection speakers, so I haven't got anything to compare you with, but I think what you do is awesome.
Thank you. I don't think any of them are using as much technology as me, but because I truly believe technology is not the villain, otherwise I wouldn't be here right now. I believe that technology, when used in the way that it was intended and created, can be a fantastic conduit for authentic connection, but it's up to our own personal responsibility to have boundaries. Like, I have really defined boundaries about my social media use. My content is prepped. So there is never I'm with my partner and our two Cavalier King Charles. I'm never like photo paparazzing us in the moment and then feeling like I've got it. I've got to get this up online in the evening. And that used to be my approach when I was in the media, because you're trained to believe your personality and people want to see your life. But I realized that they don't. Those days are kind of over, unless you're a Kardashian, who all of whom I've interviewed, by the way. So I understand that machine as well.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there are ways to use technology with healthy boundaries is my point.
Yeah. And a big part of your message is about how to connect authentically. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? I don't know whether the best place to start is with the virtual scenario a lot of us find ourselves under or not. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about authentically connecting?
I just want to say hello, speaking of authentic connection, to Matthew, Sahil, Lacey and Patience that have just dropped in as well. Lovely, very cool. So sorry, Nat, I got distracted. Your question was about connecting authentically, correct? Yeah. So I think we've all felt or been in circumstances where we're connecting, but it isn't resonant. So I define human connection as that incredible experience we've all had when we meet a person and we can feel, see, and discover ourselves in them. So there's an act of that is a little bit of mirroring, right? You have some commonalities there at play. So when you're out and you're looking to authentically connect, firstly, like, look for those commonalities. In a polarized world, look for our points of relatability. From there, you can start to build rapport through communication skills like your body language, your speech, and also you can be looking to build trust through that rapport. Now, once trust is established, you can start to bring in vulnerability. Now, if you bring in vulnerability before there's trust, we call that oversharing. And that does the opposite. And we did that. I know that well, because we used to get paid for that on the radio to overshare. You are doing the opposite then of connecting authentically. You're repelling connection. As Brené Brown says, the person didn't earn the right to hear your story. So I think what's really important is the component of disclosure before vulnerability. So self-disclosure is like me, and I just told you a little bit about me in my bio, and I said that I lived and worked in Dubai. And if you're trying to connect with me and you listened, you're like, oh, my God, my uncle lives in Dubai. And we can start. Now, that is simply disclosing information. That isn't going into vulnerability of, look, I had a really hard week and I had a severe anxiety attack. That comes after the trust is established. And I think once you follow that kind of timeline that I've seen with the research of the interviews I've done and a lot of the books I've read and the neuroscientists I've interviewed, once you follow that pattern, you're much closer to forming something real and authentic than doing the oversharing bit. Or what happens a lot these days is people don't even look for the commonalities because we're in such a polarized environment. They're actually looking at what's different. So that would be my process to seeing an authentic connection. And then you can test that over time. An authentic friendship is reciprocal. So you'll never be chasing after that person. They're pinging you as much as you're pinging them. They're checking in with you. That's a big marker on how you can tell that a relationship is authentic.
And so when you say you've interviewed neuroscientists and you've interviewed Kardashians, is this all from your previous career?
No. So one of the things that my fantastic speaking mentor taught me is, you know, when you're looking to go into the expert space, it's not just third-party research, which is like other people's books on the topics, which, by the way, I didn't start reading until a year and a half in because I really want to have an individual perspective. And what happens when you read that stuff, it hijacks your own way of explaining your research. You're all of a sudden, you're like, why am I using someone else's words almost? Oh, because I read it somewhere. So I went and I've done almost 100 interviews. Some of them are on my YouTube. We're actually putting them up now on YouTube, but they were largely done in private around my former radio job. And these are with people who I put through the matrix of a human connection superhero. So these are people who are ordinary, everyday people, but they use connection in their lives. Like in my TED talk, there's a taxi driver. I also interviewed a teacher at the autism school here in Singapore, neuroscientists, people who really have to pivot their communication in a setting every single day to literally get their paycheck. And that's very different to the connecting we did in the media where it's all contrived. I know Kim Kardashian has something to promote. I understand what I can and can't ask her. We bring her in, we try and make it look authentic. It's communication, it's not connection. And I think that is something that I've really discovered, the real difference in doing these research interviews versus doing media interviews is very different.
Yeah, because you've got all those guidelines of what you can and can't.
Yeah.
The topics you can and can't cover.
It's very contrived.
Yeah, which we don't have here on Monday Night Live. It's wide open.
Exactly. Ask anything you like.
Thanks so much for jumping in the chat, guys. If you just joined us, jump in and say hello. By the way, as we're going, you're more than welcome to ask Simone any questions you like. We'll bring them in and bring them up. There's no boundaries here on Monday Night Live. So, Simone, did you always know that you wanted to be in the broadcasting business, or was this something that, how did you get into that in the first place?
Yeah, I did a communications degree at university and actually went to study. I wanted to do theatre. I wanted to be an actor. And I remember I was at Curtin University one day and I realised that a lot of my friends in there were all like devoted to the theatre. So they would fail all their other university units so they could still stay in the Hayman Theatre at Curtin and not actually graduate. And I just watched this and I thought, but why? Like, I didn't understand why. And I realized actually what I was really very interested in too was the idea of being in show business, like the business part of it, which is why I'm so adoptive of marketing in what I do, because I see the value of that. So I thought, well, that's not very good. If you're not so interested in being an artist, right, and learning the craft of acting, and you are more fascinated by the packaging and the marketing, then maybe a good happy medium for you would actually be something like broadcasting, because it marries, there's craft to it, and you're still using a lot of those things like your voice, your presence, and your emotiveness, all those things, but you really get to learn about, marketing, content creation, events, public speaking. Like, it was really a fantastic occupation for my personality at the time until I outgrew it.
Yeah. And Yahoo said that you were in, when was it, 2020.
Yeah, December
of last year. You know where I'm going with this. Yahoo named Simone one of the top 10 public speaking coaches globally. That's amazing. Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, it was so nice.
It's nice. I mean, this is just one of Simone's many accolades, but like, so you're obviously coaching a lot of people on public speaking. What's one of the major challenges that you find that speakers have to overcome that you help them with?
I think the biggest issue here in Asia for Asian people is the fear of speaking up, because we're raised to be quiet, and we've raised particularly Asian women to feel that it, you know, it's already women believe it's really unattractive. We've been conditioned to think it's unattractive to be outspoken, but you couple that with culture, and it's almost a suffocating fear about being disobedient. And so that is something that is really hard. Interestingly, the more my profile has grown as a presentation skills coach, a communications coach, is I am attracting more and more women that have overcome that block already, and now they're just wanting to go next level. So when I first started coaching, that issue was something that was coming up again and again and again. So that is a big, that, I mean, that confidence issue is obviously a big thing for a lot of people, but it's particularly profound here. It's the one thing that, if, when you ask me that question, really sticks out for me.
Yeah. So when you were in Perth growing up, were your parents here as well, or were you a boarder?
Yeah.
So how come you ended up back in Singapore?
So when I moved to Singapore for the first time, so I was here 2005. I was working for Channel V as a VJ in Malaysia, so I was based here, and then I got into media. And then I went to Dubai, and then after that, I went back to Perth to take care of mum. And I think what I realized was I had just been away for too long, and I just got used to living a kind of expatriate lifestyle, I think, to be really honest. And the way that I worked and the way that I operated, I don't think it would be the same now if I was back in Perth, but certainly 2014 was, you know, it's almost a decade ago now. So, yeah, so then for me, yeah, so I really actually wanted to go back to Dubai. And it was just 11 hours away. It was too far away from my mum, who's in a nursing home in Perth. So I was like, where on the map is the closest cosmopolitan city to Perth that I could see her every 90 days? And Sydney was actually further away than Singapore from Perth. So I was like, okay, I'm going to come back to Singapore. And that was hard because I didn't have a great time in Singapore for the first time I lived here, because I was earning like pittance in the media. And Singapore is the most expensive city in the world. So it's not as fun when you, nowhere is fun when you don't have money, guys. So I really had to graft very, very hard to have the life. I still do the life that I have in Singapore now, and can just launch the things that I want to launch and invest in the business the way that I want to invest in it. And that's what brought me back. And I kept my word. I saw her every 90 days until COVID. And then COVID hit and I didn't see her for 16 months. And then I was recently back in Perth. I literally got home. A week later, Perth went into a mini lockdown. And then a week after that, Singapore announced tightening their measures. And now there's a new rule that, you know, if you go out of Singapore, when you come back, it's 21 days quarantine now. So I just got to see her at the best window. I'm so happy I went in April.
Yeah, but that wasn't easy, was it? Tell everyone what you had to go through to make that trip.
Oh, I had to go. Sorry, someone's just written, LinkedIn user, you were born in Singapore. Though, yes, I was born in Singapore. Yeah, so I did two weeks of quarantine. 2 weeks of quarantine in Perth. I had to get a G2G pass to enter, I think, the state of WA. On top of that, I needed a permission from the Aussie government to enter Australia. So you know, nationwide, then state. And then I had to get permission to get out and return to Singapore. In between then, there's PCR tests. And then I had to get a 2020 Australian flu shot to enter the nursing home to see my mum. And then when I came home, I came straight through and was fine. And so I didn't have to do.
You had to do a 2 week lockdown, didn't you, in Perth?
Absolutely. And I actually really freaking enjoyed it. Is that terrible?
Oh, really? Yeah,
because it was kind of really indulgent alone time. Like on Easter Sunday, I drank red wine and Easter eggs. I watched The Serpent on Netflix. And my partner's quite a fitness freak, and I feel judged if I do that here. I got to honour my inner bogan and just do that, and that was fantastic. That was really great.
Wow, I haven't heard of anyone that's enjoyed doing the 2 week lockdown. I think I'd struggle with it.
Yeah, that's what everyone says. But, you know, it's I wrote about this because of what I've been through with some of the isolating moments and the trauma in my life. And last year I spent lockdown almost it was 3 month lockdown in Singapore, living on my own by myself. I hadn't lived with my partner yet. Yeah, and so I was alone. So I feel like a lot of the hard things that you go through in life, for anyone watching this, actually prepare you to be more resilient for other things. But that doesn't mean that I didn't get hit with all of the science about, so I'm going to drop a science bomb on you here. When scientists, a lady called Dr. Louise Hawkley, does the studies of how people, like people who are lonely, one of the markers that they look at is measuring something called microawakenings in the sleep. So people who are lonely have more of these microawakenings. And in day five of lockdown, someone like me who knows all about connection, who's videoing with my friends, who's trying to do everything virtually from lockdown that I can in the Hyatt in Perth, still by day five, that started to happen to me. And so there's part of it that's wired into us, the science behind human connection, that is inescapable. And it is something that affects us, obviously, everyone to different degrees, introverts maybe less than extroverts, but we're all on that spectrum and it is how our brains are wired. So
what's this micro awakenings? What does that mean?
Exactly what it seems to describe, like having surface level sleep and rousing multiple times in your sleep. And what it is from is when we were evolving as early man in hunter-gatherer societies, if we were cast out of the tribe, we had safety numbers, if we were cast out of that tribe, we would have to rouse many times in the night to keep watch for ourselves for predators, saber-toothed tigers. Now, when we're in the tribe, people take turns to keep watch. We're on our own. So to this day, when we are feeling lonely or perceive ourselves to be alone, those micro awakenings will kick back in. And so day five of quarantine, I remember very, very viscerally my quality of sleep started to go down. Even though the first 5 days I enjoyed it very much. It was very good.
Jeez, I'm starting to get worried I'm lonely because I have these micro awakenings, all the time.
It's exactly what I said was like I didn't perceive that I was a lonely person. I actually quite enjoyed having that alone time. So when we choose solitude, it's actually very healthy for us. What happens in the human brain that's really dark is when the solitude is imposed, like solitary confinement, lockdowns, things that we can't control. That's where some of this stuff happens. So you might be yearning. Okay, here's my question for you, Nat. There is a study talks about orbits of loneliness. Okay, so there's something called intimate loneliness, and this is where we yearn for a romantic partner. The next orbit is relational loneliness. This is a yearning for intimate family and friends. So this is like if you're not talking to your family, there's a big rift, or maybe you don't have really good friends. And then the last one is called collective loneliness. And this is when people feel lonely when they don't have a common group with a common purpose. It could be a cycling group. It could be like me, other people who are into the same things as me. So if you're missing one of those orbits, Nat, my question to you would be lean into whichever orbit you're a bit light on, and that could unlock the sleep key.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, all right. Some good advice. I'm gonna take note. Matthew's dropped in here. Love your vibe, love your content, Simone. Another powerhouse to follow and connect with. Just like, it's so nice. Thanks, mate. When's the book coming out?
The book should be coming out. I submitted it today, so it should be coming out in December if I'm lucky. But Nat will probably know this. December is not a good time to launch things, guys. It's like a super busy time in the year. Everyone's rushing deadlines, and no one really is looking to do anything. So it's November. I actually think either we rush it and get done by November so that people can get this message while the world still really needs it, or, you know, January. Before Chinese New Year is my way of looking at it. So sometime at the end of the year.
And Simone, you're studying at Harvard. Are you still doing that?
Finished it in the last quarter, but didn't get my certificate till like a month ago. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was very hard work.
what was the degree you were doing?
It was a certificate in higher education teaching. So to help with my coaching and, you know, I'm not the best teachers sometimes, I think I'm really very highly motivated and very disciplined, and sometimes that can make me impatient with my students, that I felt that my empathy was missing sometimes. Not that I would not that I would present that way, but in my mind, I could hear my impatience. And so I thought, I need to go and do something that's going to let me learn more about how to teach properly and how to be more patient and more empathetic and read and connect with my students better. And it has helped a great, great deal. Because you learn about UDL, the Universal Design for Learning, they just tell you, like, different people learn in different ways and should be allowed to show the outcomes of their learning in different ways. And that was like a big hit over the head.
Well, you did this post last week where you said you explained how much you work on your business and your marketing, and you sort of shared it because you said that sometimes you've had some feedback where people think that you don't work that much. And when I was reading it, I was thinking, I think the complete opposite. Like, I think of myself, she works so hard. I was actually surprised when you said how much you work. It was like 50, 60 hours. I was like, oh, that's not as much as I thought.
I have to stop myself. It doesn't mean I'm not thinking about work, though, you see, Nat. Like, it doesn't mean I'm not walking the dogs and thinking about work. Look, it's interesting because I think in the non-Asian context, because I look very Asian to Western people, there is that kind of bias there, like, oh, you know, the grafting migrant child. But actually in the Asian context, they really see the non-Asian blood in me.
Yeah.
And then it's more like, here's a Eurasian Barbie doll and I'm sure she doesn't work. So when I did the personal branding audit, it was not with people outside of this market, right? So that's just me being very, you know, I find all these things fascinating and very humorous, and I don't take it with a chip on my shoulder about, you know, being stuck between two worlds, because I actually think it's a huge blessing to be in the middle of East and West, but that is just how it is. So it was more spoken to those people, but certainly when I was in the media, I worked a lot harder for about a third of the money. So I'm not adverse when there is a big month, like, you know, April was a very, very big month. July will be a big month. Those are the months that you will work more, especially if you're studying it. It'll be crazy, but you do whatever you have to do if you love your business and you want your business to survive in basically what's a global recession, guys. Let's not beat around the bush. So
yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's next? What are you excited about in your business at the moment?
So I am in talks to do an audio documentary. I can't say more than that because I signed an NDA, but that's really, really very, very exciting. And this month I will finish my online course. I'm really super excited to create something that will hopefully allow me to work a little bit less but still bring revenue into the business. And I say that to add value to any of the people on here who are business owners. Yes, I have a mission and that's incredible, but at the same time, I can't be a great human connector to people in my life if I'm fatigued. That is the truth. So when I created I have a membership that I created last year in lockdown, and I absolutely love it. It's called Courageous Speaking, and it allows for a very small fee people to access the same content that I do to multinational corporations for, you know, five figures. And so that, I absolutely love that because there's so much connection in that, but it's scalable. So every time there's new people in the community, I don't feel this weight of how am I going to get more work done? You know, but yet the stuff that I love, the human connection, I still get. So my advice to anyone who's watching this is whatever you're doing, see if you can find the happy medium. See if you can sit there and think, this is my problem with my business. This is what I need more of. This is what I don't need more of. What models can I Google and search that exist to satisfy, to heal this problem?
Yeah, that's great advice. Patience from Brooklyn has asked if you can elaborate a bit on your theory on emotions get connections into motion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patience. So that is what we call a foundational phrase that you put into a keynote. So the other one is commonality connects. Emotion gets connection into motion is one of them. And what that means is when we are the first to emote, and it's specifically very relevant here in Asia where we are raised to kind of give face, which is like a very neutral expression. When we show our emotions freely, it shows a transparency. And when we're transparent, people trust us more. It's like if I avert my eye contact from the camera right now and I do my whole conversation with Nat and I don't look at the camera, do you believe that I'm a transparent person? No, because the human brain perceives people who don't give direct eye contact as not trustworthy.
So I'm doing this wrong. Yeah.
So giving those facial expressions, those hands, all of that emotional display bravely and courageously first when you meet people will allow them to get their connection. They're going to mirror you back. They're going to match your energy, and that will allow momentum and motion to be built in your connection. So it's particularly special, remember, in terms of meeting new connections when we can do it, not on Zoom, but even on Zoom, it still applies.
Yeah, you do it so well looking at the camera. I want to see your face when I'm talking to you. So I look down here. But yeah, there's a lot better problems up here.
That's totally fine. Like I'm looking at your face. I'm looking at Nat's face too when Nat is speaking. I defer attention when he's speaking. But the rule is when I'm speaking, I give you the eye contact so that you can feel we can connect. Yeah.
Something I've got to work on, but I'm doing it now.
You've got all my Instagram tips pounding this in. I just re-recorded this tip again for TikTok because I feel like we need a reminder.
Yeah, awesome. We covered that off. Cool. So, Simone, I've got a really important question for you now.
Sure.
If there was a question I should have asked you that I haven't asked you yet, what would that be?
I thought you were going to say, what was Kim Kardashian like to interview? I thought that was what you were going to ask. I feel like I'm super, super happy to be here. I would love for all of you to connect with me. That would be my happiest thing if you would connect.
Whereabouts? Instagram?
Instagram is great. I think that actually works better because there are a bit more people on LinkedIn than there are on Instagram. So Instagram is a nice place to go. And there are loads of free tips on connection and communication there. But also I'll give you, just DM me and I will give you the place where I can, you know, send you great stuff on our email list too and update you on when the book's coming out, things like that.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, everyone. And Simone, thanks so much for your time. And I really appreciate your time. And guys, go connect with Simone on LinkedIn and Instagram and have a great week in business. Go out there and crush it, guys. You want to answer this last one quickly?
Yeah, he just slipped in there. Louis Montero. Does human connection always require kind of transactional value sharing, or can we connect just by the sake of connecting? Hi, Louis. I love this question because when I started working on the topic, I made a real distinction between the people who kind of speak about networking, which is very transactional, you know, the swapping of the business card, that kind of thing, versus how I wanted to look at human connection. So even in my branding and the content I put out, I had to make that distinction very, very clear. So this kind of transactional value sharing, I think that human connection is an energetic exchange. And I will, in case Louis dropped in a bit later, just remind you, my definition is it's that experience we've all had when we can see, feel, and discover ourselves in another human being. So it's not exactly, in my definition anyway, this idea of any sort of transaction happening. It's an energetic exchange, but it doesn't absolutely have to be transactional. What I mean by reciprocity later, when a connection that you meet becomes an ongoing long-term friendship, a good way to see that it's mutual and authentic is that there will be no one party will be chasing the affection of another. So it's very much like, hey, mate, how are you going? Shall we catch up? Yeah, sure, blah, blah, blah. It isn't somebody not replying to you or a friend canceling on you 12 times. That's always a good marker. If you're looking at your circles of connection and going, does this person value me as much as I value them or vice versa? That's a really good marker. And of course, we can connect just by the sake of connecting. Like, you know, obviously, when we meet someone, we might know when we're traveling, when we can travel, that we might not ever see that person again. But in that moment, if there's compassion and true humanity shared in that moment, just kindness. So, for example, the other day, my partner and I were out walking with the dogs because we're in semi-lockdown. That's what you're allowed to do. And there was an old gentleman, like a guy my father's age, he would have been 70 years old, very slim Chinese Singaporean man sitting on like a, is it called a bollard mat? The things that you sit on in the car park, right? And he was breathing quite heavily in his mask. And I was like, hey, uncle, are you okay? Like, do you need anything? And he said, oh, you know, I just have a cramp in my leg. And he's like rubbing his leg. And he just looked us in the eyes. And I saw, you know, my dad's passed away. I saw a flash of this man that looked like my father. And in that moment, he and I had an exchange. And he said, you know, thank you so much. And I said, you know, we can book you a taxi if you want to go home. He said, no, it's okay. My house is just up there. So I will probably never see this man again. I didn't end up giving him a cab home, but in the act of showing that he's not forgotten by the tribe, there was an energetic exchange there. And so connection can happen just in the act of connecting, if that's what you mean, Louis.
What a great story to end a Monday Night Live session with. All right. So thank you so much for being here, guys. Again, Simone, thanks once again. Have a fantastic week in business, and good night, everyone.